Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, January 18th, 2026, and this is episode 25 of The Rift. Here in central and southern Illinois, we are witnessing, in all likelihood, the final years of the coal industry. Frantic efforts by the Trump administration to prolong the lives of failing coal plants notwithstanding, the economic viability of coal as an energy source has been in decline for decades, and the state of Illinois has mandated that all coal-fired power plants close by 2030. Since the advent of commercial coal mining in the state in the early 1800s, over 7,400 coal mines have operated in Illinois. But that number has dwindled to fewer than 30 active coal mines today. Coal towns in Illinois have been left to reckon with dwindling tax bases, declining populations, and the complexity of balancing jobs, families, and identities tied to coal with the environmental harm wrought by the industry. A similar story is playing out in southeastern Ohio's coal country, although it's further along. Coal's decline began earlier there, and today only around 500 people in the entire state of Ohio work in coal mines. Even so, the influence of coal mining still echoes throughout southeast Ohio's former coal towns today, as community members try to chart a path forward in the wake of an energy transition that's been going on for much longer than many people realize. That's why for today's show, I spoke with Tyler McDaniel and Kelly Blosser, president and vice president, respectively, of the Little Cities of Black Diamonds Council, an organization focused on preserving the history of the region while promoting community and economic development for its current residents. After the break, you'll hear our conversation about the history of coal mining in southeast Ohio, how it shows up in the people and environment today, and how Tyler and Kelly are trying to build community and well-being through ecotourism. But first, programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by Live Action Games. If you're looking for a wide selection of classic and modern video games, consoles, controllers, books, and collectibles, Live Action Games has you covered. Live Action Games is open Tuesday through Saturday at 111 North Market Street in downtown Champaign, right next door to us here at WEFT. New and gently used inventory arrives daily. For a list of in-stock items or additional Live Action Games information, please visit lag217.com or call 217-359-4863. That's 217-359-GAME. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you in part by Make It Champaign-Urbana. Make It Champaign-Urbana provides programs to assist new residents in getting connected to the community through the Champaign Welcome Crew. Are you passionate about the community? As an ambassador, you can help make a difference to new residents by answering their questions and sharing your community experiences. Ready to join over 50 ambassadors making a difference? For more information, visit makeitcu.com. And now, here's my conversation with Kelly Blosser and Tyler McDaniel of the Little Cities of Black Diamonds Council. I'm joined now by Kelly Blosser and Tyler McDaniel of the Little Cities of Black Diamonds Council. Kelly and Tyler, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So just to jump right into it, what is the Little Cities of Black Diamonds region, and why do you think it's important?
Yeah, so the Little Cities of Black Diamonds region is a roughly 800 square mile area in southeast Ohio. It covers parts of Athens, Hocking, Morgan, and Perry counties. And within that region, there are about 75 communities that identify as little cities. And all of these, they range from incorporated villages that have active governments to unincorporated township areas, and even ghost towns that may only have a handful of residents. So that's the little part of little cities. And the name itself comes from a newspaper in the 1800s that was trying to describe this tight cluster of coal towns that dotted the landscape. So those were all referred to as the little cities of Black Diamonds. So these communities today are kind of bonded together by a shared history and a shared microculture. And it's part of a region that we think is really vibrant and interesting, and we're trying to help grow through tourism.
Great. And I'm curious, what your story is, both you and Tyler, how you came to be doing this work and what you hope to accomplish with it.
Yeah, I'll start and we'll kind of do both of us. So I came into this work actually because my mother is one of the co-founders of the organization. So I was a little kid coloring in the corner at this group's first meetings. And through really up to my teenage years, I got to see through her work the organization grow and the work that they were doing. But then I went to college, moved away, and I didn't really get involved myself until I moved back around 2017. And then I slowly became re-involved in the organization. And now I think a lot of it for me is that I'm passionate about the causes, but I'm also really passionate about seeing my mother's work live on, and all the things that she's done for the last 30 years, seeing those into a new era. So that's a big part of it for me.
My story, I grew up in Hocking County, just actually a few minutes from Hocking Hill State Park, which is a really famous tourism destination here in our state. I grew up there, lived there most of my life. Both my parents, my mom and dad's families, have long histories to Southeast Ohio and this region, and also being part of the coal mining and industrial histories that have happened here for many generations. Having that tie to the region, I've also just been fascinated with history my whole life. And so as I learned about the history of this region, which I had no idea really until I started to, engage with Little Cities of Black Diamonds. I joined them in 2019, and I had known about some of the history, but I really didn't know a lot about like how important that this region was. It was really that's what kind of brought me in was I've always had that passion, and I found, a group of people that have similar passions to me. And we incorporated a few years ago, and I've been our president ever since. So that's something I take great pride in.
Great, yeah. And on that note, talking about history, I'm curious if you guys could talk just a little bit about the history of the region. I know that we've kind of touched on coal mining being a really important part of it, and labor organizing and unionism. What is just, very broadly speaking, the history of the region?
When we started as an organization, a lot of the history we focused on here was the coal mining history. So, this region at one point was a major center for coal mining and shipped coal out all across the United States. And so we played a very big role in fueling the Industrial Revolution. And there were other industries here as well, like salt and iron and clay. So one of the things Tyler and I like to do is when we visit other cities, we'll kind of spot the bricks that came from our region. It just gives us a sense of the impact that this region had industrially. Now, since we have kind of explored this history, we've gotten to think of the history a little bit differently and to be much better about acknowledging there was a lot here before coal. You know, there was a lot here before European settlement. And I think we're still doing the work of uncovering some of the really cool indigenous history of this region. You know, we have Adena earthworks here all over the place, and it's really, it's been exciting to learn a lot more about all the people that were here before the mines ever came. But what we do know the most about is the mining era, because that's when these towns were incorporated. And a lot of the communities here were founded as mining towns, you know, so developers came in, they opened a mine, they built a lot of houses, and then the miners came and lived in those houses. And one of the crucial parts of our story is that the miners who came here were very passionate about labor organizing. And many of them, even before they immigrated from the UK and, you know, like Scotland, Ireland, England, Wales, you know, they were already passionate about their labor rights, and they sort of imported the labor movement to this region. So we had a very active organizing scene, and this part of Ohio was actually District 1 of the state union at one time, because we were the leading coal mining district and the leading labor organizing district. This region had some very impactful strikes, and we actually got blamed for a lot of other strikes across the country. You know, at one point, you know, newspapers would write things like "dynamiters trained in the Hocking Valley and then moved here to start organizing our miners," you know, and things like that. So the labor history became a really crucial part of our story. And then immigration became a crucial part of our story, because when all of those English and Scottish and Welsh and Irish miners went on strike, somebody had to come in to work those jobs. And a lot of effort was put into recruiting migrants from the South, which included a lot of African Americans, miners from Chicago, Pittsburgh, and New York that were largely first-generation immigrants. And so we ended up having settlement here from people from all over the globe. And we've actually put together a map at one point of all the places that we can confirm people came here from. And it goes all the way, you know, you've got countries like Germany that we had a lot of immigration from, but also Eastern European countries, you know, like what was called Bohemia at the time, that's more like Czechia today. And Italy, we've got migrants from Turkey, from Brazil, from China, from Russia. So this really was an incredible destination of all of these different cultural groups. And that has become a crucial part of our history, too, because it formed this really unique microculture that only exists here in Southeast Ohio.
I would add, too, that some of the stories of what we call elders, you know, like the older folks in these, some of the nonprofits and history-minded folks that we work with, they, as kids in the mid-century, can remember meeting people that spoke, you know, different languages, some of them four or five, six different languages or pieces of them, so that they could communicate with other community members that, you know, didn't speak some of the other languages, but there were people that were trying to, you know, facilitate communication between each other, even in the mid-century, a few decades after a lot of the mines closed.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And it's funny, it sounds so similar to some of the mining history we have here in Central and Southern Illinois with, you know, it's a very similar story of European immigrants kind of bringing their unionism and labor organizing with them, and bringing black workers up here as strike breakers, often without telling them they were going to be strike breakers, which contributed to some serious tensions and, you know, battles across labor lines and racial lines in Central and Southern Illinois. But, you know, Tyler, as you were kind of talking about, I'm very curious what kind of presence coal mining has in the region today, you know, whether there's any actual current mines there, but also just the culture, the history, you know, if there are people who kind of still hold on to that identity as mining families and people who that history is really important to.
Oh, absolutely. So I guess to begin, the first part of the question, there are a few mines still active in Southeast Ohio, very small scale, compared to what they were almost a century ago, or they really, I say a century, but like that's when a lot of the mines closed, but there were still a handful or more of pretty sizable mines that continued through World War II, and closed, around the 19 late 40s into the 50s. But there have been a couple mines that opened in like the 90s or 2000s and have since closed. So it's a much smaller scale, pretty, and I would almost say insignificant as far as the employment in the region. There's very, very few. Anybody that does work, and I have met some people that have family members that are employed by coal mining or coal mines, but they have to drive a few hours away, into West Virginia or Southwest Pennsylvania or somewhere like that. Somewhere else. It's not here. But it's fascinating. So like I said, I'm from Hocking County, and Hocking Hill State Park and the tourism that is kind of the western two-thirds of the county, but the eastern third of the county is w or was heavily coal mined. Like there are purpose-built coal towns all over that part, in southern Perry County and in Athens and Morgan counties, like Kelly was saying, our region. But people, even though very, very few were employed in the last couple generations in coal mining, because we did have strip mining, surface strip mining, through essentially the 1980s and 90s, that pretty much started in the 50s and went through until the end of the 20th century. But again, very few jobs in compared or as compared to everybody that did live here and does live here. But we still have people that, their great grandpa or grandpa or somebody worked in the mines in the 20s, 30s, 40s, but they consider themselves part of a coal mining family. And I find that very fascinating and very, it's really kind of special when you talk to somebody, because it's like this industry that existed here so long ago now, really, and so long ago, especially in regard to the economic history of our region, and people are still identifying that they're from coal mining families. And I'll kind of toss it over to Kelly on this too, because she's, like I said, like I lived around or closer to the Hocking Hill State Park, so I was, while it sounds I was really close to these coal towns, I didn't really travel through them until I joined Little Cities of Black Diamonds and started to actually explore the region more. So yeah, she has some, some insight into that, I think.
I would definitely say the history of coal mining has influenced almost every aspect of life here today. And like Tyler said, we do still have people who identify as, we're coal miners, even if no one in their family has actually set foot in a mine for almost 100 years, because it's that much a part of their identity. Something that Little Cities is focused on is what we call heritage skills, which are, sometimes very tangible skills and sometimes more like a mindset, but things that have been passed down from the mining era to modern day. So you will still see today a lot of people are tinkerers. A lot of people like to work on their own, like they take a lot of pride in working on their own cars, and they're very frustrated when computerized parts got under the sea. And they like to build things. They like to do wood carving. They like to do blacksmithing. They like to really use a lot of these skills that have been passed down in their family from generation to generation. And they take a lot of pride in that. You also see this really kind of anti-authoritarian mindset in the region that is almost certainly a relic of our labor history. People are very distrustful of outside authorities. They're very distrustful of government, and law enforcement. And we see a lot of that here. But you also see this incredible work ethic And you see people who there's a lot of endurance of really hard labor, and a lot of people who almost have a hard time adjusting to labor that isn't very physical. So we will see people, like one of the examples I use is people get injured and they don't like to go to the doctor and they like to work through it, and it can be really hard and frustrating for people who are trying to influence health outcomes in the region, because they're like, why won't these people go to the doctor? He just dislocated his shoulder and he won't let anybody look at it, But I think a lot of those things come from a heritage where there were severe consequences to seeing a doctor when you were injured. There were severe consequences to admitting you were injured. And so we see a lot of these things just as part of the culture. We also see a lot of really interesting art and expression. There are a lot of really interesting folk arts and a lot of that like outside art that takes place in this region. And people love to make art out of things like car parts. They love to make art out of found objects or like to create things that are kind of a sampling of that industrial past. And I think that's really, it's really cool to see how all of that mining culture has influenced not just people's labor and those aspects of their lives, but everything else as well.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to hear how, again, this is all stuff from, 50 to 100 years ago, and it's still kind of reverberating out through the community today. And of course, one of the other areas in which that is true is the environment and the landscape, right? And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, how coal mining has affected the environment locally and the landscape of the region.
Yeah, it's impacted it a lot. I don't think it can be overstated how much of an impact it has had. Like we talked about, how there were salt works and, clay and iron industries along with coal here. And I think, all of those, including coal mining, requires a lot of timber. And so, right from the beginning of, even before, like even before the Civil War, we, in this region, there was a canal built to access the salt and iron and some of the timber, at that point. And then after the Civil War, there was investment in railroads, and that just exploded, the natural resource extraction here. And along with that went a lot of the trees and the forests of Southeast Ohio. We have images in our archive from the turn of the century, early 1900s, and there's like two trees, and it's like a bird's eye view of from somebody standing on a hillside overlooking this town of like, I don't know, 1,000, 2,000 people, and you see like three trees, and that's it. And it's funny because nowadays people come here to hike through forests. So what happened was in the 1930s during the Great Depression, there were efforts to kind of reforest a lot of the landscape because there was erosion happening, pretty serious and significant erosion because there just wasn't an understanding that if you take all the trees away and all the vegetation, there's going to be heavy erosion whenever it rains, even a small rainstorm. So there was a lot of stories about that in the teens and 20s happening. And so, yeah, in the 1930s, there was a massive effort to kind of replant forest with kind of systematically to bring nutrients back into the soil so that things could, because there's only a few things that could grow. Like one of the things you see around here still are large pine trees. And that was because in the 30s, that's what they used because that provided pH into the soil from that specific type of pine tree. And so, you see these thriving forests around these pine groves. And the reason that they're there is because of those pine groves. So that has had a huge impact. Again, like we can, reforest this region, but you can't bring back the original forest that was taken out kind of, in the 1800s that was here, for countless generations and was used by ancient peoples that called this place home, So it, you can never bring that back, but you can do what you can to you know, at least restore it to the best of our ability today. On top of that, though, as with so many places with coal mines, especially coal mines that were abandoned prior to the 1970s here, where there were state regulations where if you closed the coal mine up, you had to actually secure it, and you know, you couldn't just close up shop, so to speak, and abandon it. So a lot of our mines, of course, were several decades before the 1970s when they closed. They were just abandoned, left open. So mines would flood and water would come out. Chemical reactions, of course, happen, and acid mine drainage comes about. And so one of the stories that I've learned from Kelly and talking to other people of different generations, even, you know, in school, when they would be asked to, like, draw a creek or draw, you know, some kind of scene from maybe something that they like a park or something, well, they would use an orange crayon instead of a blue crayon to draw the water, because they were so used to seeing orange water filled with acid mine drainage. So, you know, that has impacted us a lot too, and there are efforts to try and clean that up. A few different things and a few different organizations and folks here in Southeast Ohio, and that's, you know, that's a massive undertaking that's going to be, you know, for countless generations still. On top of that too, we also have a large continuously burning fire underground, because during the Great Hocking Valley Coal Strike of 1884-1885, which was a very significant national strike, some coal miners they were just fed up. They didn't want to put up with striking anymore, and the mine owners, so they set a bunch of mines on fire. They set about 7 or 8 mines on fire. Most of them did get put out, but a few of them kept burning, and they're still burning to this day, even after many efforts in the late 1800s and through the 1900s to try and put it out. But it still is burning, and it's probably going to burn for hundreds, maybe 1,000 years or more still, because it's a very large coal seam underground. But that has impacted people because, one, there have been many people that have had to move out of their homes at different times because of sinkholes or gas coming up out of the ground that was very toxic and very dangerous. So people had to move around. Pieces of communities had to be abandoned and rebuilt, like on the other side of town, things like that. The topography has shifted because there is a 10 to 12 foot plus coal seam that has burned out, and so the ground will just sink because there's nothing there now to support the ground. So there's been a lot of shifting and movement all over, especially southern Perry County, where that was started. And so roads, you know, in the 1960s and 70s had to be shut down and rerouted because a giant sinkhole opened up right there where the mine fire had burned out the coal. So there's been a lot of impact to the environment here, and a lot of kind of adversity, or a lot of people have faced adversity in one way or another from one or all three of those.
Right, and I know that a little bit later we're going to get into talking about what you all are doing about that, but just to sort of get a little bit more background first, I'm curious if you just generally, if you could talk about what some of the main challenges the region and communities in your region are facing today.
Yeah, so this region faced about a century of extraction followed by a century of abandonment. So a lot of the resources that used to be here aren't anymore, and then nothing was really rebuilt in their place. So what we see is we have seen a real lack of infrastructure, and it has led to all sorts of adverse effects. So we have low access to housing, to education, to employment. We are an Ohio Health Improvement Zone because of all the adverse health effects that come out of this area. We see people struggling with intergenerational poverty and really like the whole laundry list of things that just come along with poverty and a dereliction of resources. And what has been really difficult and frustrating is that because the people here lack access to capital, it has been really challenging to rebuild. So even when there was a great deal of citizen engagement and a lot of volunteer efforts, you need money to fix a foundation, you need money to to maintain a park, you need money to build an administrative building or to have a fire department or to run water lines. So our group has been doing organized tours since the 90s, and we have all of this fascinating stuff to see, and people come in to see these heritage stories. They come in for the outdoor recreation, but they can't go to the bathroom. They don't have anywhere to stay. They don't have anywhere to eat, And there are a few restaurants, but there isn't nearly enough infrastructure to support the tourists that want to visit the area. So a big part of what we struggle with now is just finding ways to rebuild that infrastructure so that the people who live here, can have a stable, healthy quality of life. There's also, I like to talk about not all resources are tangible. So one of the biggest things that I think has impacted the region is just this lack of a vision for our own future. So people have spent so many generations just trying to survive that they can't really plan beyond that. There's a lot of living for today going on, and there isn't a lot of hope for what I could accomplish with my life, beyond just getting through it. And so we do see a lot of depression, and you see a lot of suicidality, and we just see a lot of people who feel a kind of aimlessness, that they're trying to fight against. So part of what we've been doing for the last 3 decades is trying to use our heritage stories to build pride and to help people identify what they have that is of value and help them start to see that their contributions and their expression are meaningful and are something that people are interested in engaging. And we also are looking really at the connections between a tourism economy and local people, because something that happens a lot when you don't have access to capital is that tourism just brings a lot of people who want to buy everything up. So they want to buy all the housing and turn it into Airbnbs. They want to buy all the businesses and run them for themselves. And the owner lives in Cleveland or lives in Columbus and comes down once every few months to make sure, the lights are still on. And that doesn't really help to support the people who live here. So we're trying really hard to help identify what are the community assets that are meaningful to us and to try to connect local people to those assets and invest in the people who live here so that they can build their own businesses, so that if there's an Airbnb, it's run by somebody who lives in this region and things like that. So I think it really is one of our biggest challenges is just getting people to that point where, well, it's convincing people from outside the region who have that access to capital to invest in the local people who live here rather than just extracting the assets, and benefiting from it themselves.
Yeah, and so on that note, I know that the main project that you guys are working on right now is something called the Little Cities Eco Heritage Corridor. And so I'm wondering if you could just talk about what that is and why you think it's important and how it might address some of these issues that you've just talked about.
Yeah, so the Little Cities Eco Heritage Corridor is a strategic initiative to establish the Little Cities of Black Diamonds region as a destination for tourism. And we're particularly focused on heritage tourism and ecotourism. A lot of our efforts within the corridor project are to bring together partners because there are a lot of different organizations and a lot of individuals who have been all working toward this same goal. So the Eco Heritage Corridor seeks to coordinate us all under a strategy so that we can have more capacity working together than we would have working on our own. We within that are focusing on building out some of that tourism infrastructure. So we have a few sites that we're trying to invest in as gateway sites, to have places where people can, where they can go to the bathroom and they can shop, you know, and they can get directions and, you know, all of these things that are really necessary to support that tourism. And also just working together to see what common needs we have that we might be able to apply for grant funding or might be able to invest some of the other funding that we have really smartly. One of the big pieces of the Eco-Heritage Corridor project is this idea of the heritage economy, which is where we try to find ways to build out a place for local people within the tourism economy so that it's not just about bringing tourists in and getting them to spend money here. It's about finding ways that tourism can create engagement between people from outside the region and people from within the region and can create appreciation of the culture that's here and of the environment that's here today. And finding ways that the skills that I talked about, you know, all those skills that we have because we were miners and all that work ethic and all that artistry and craftsmanship can be appreciated and can be an important part of the tourism economy. So directly connecting that tourism experience with the local people is a huge part of that strategy that we're working on. And that comes from everything from, you know, coming up with brick and mortar centralized storefronts where people can sell locally produced goods, or it comes from having festivals that local people can attend but also can draw people in from outside the region. And it comes from things like hiring practices, you know, and our commitment to trying to build jobs for local people and trying to compensate people for the work that they're doing.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, like, I kind of got caught up in just the emotion of that, you know, and like thinking about what we do and like, because I mean, this is also things, you know, it's important to us. I'm going to say it's important to us personally, because, you know, I'm involved with the Heritage Interpreter program too, because, you know, it's, I want to share out my history and the expertise that I have. But I don't have, or I didn't have the skill sets to do that, but this program has allowed me to be much better at it. And it's helped a few other people. You know, so that, you know, we want to keep growing it. We want to, you know, because there's so many things. One of the cool things that we have seen, and I have seen because I kind of took over our social media when I joined back in 2019, and it's amazing the amount of people that engage on there and want to tell their stories. They just have no outlet to do it, or no way to do it, or no even how to. So we post an old image or talk about something, like a people or certain people, a family, a mine, a particular mine, a particular town. It could be anything. And people just jump in and just, I remember that. I remember when that old coal mine infrastructure was still standing when I was a kid in the 1940s, you know, or... I remember that old storefront, and we used to go in there when I was really young in the 1950s, and I would go in with my dad and grandparents, and we would go, you know, shop there. And so there's all of these people that want to tell their story and tell their memories and connection to this place. And that's why I'm really excited about, you know, it's not, we're not just providing a space like social media. That was the beginning, but now we really want to see people be able to make money by doing it, you know, be able to get paid to go do speaking engagements or get paid to meet a tour group at a certain site and give their views or talk about their memories or stories that they remember or share. Like, for example, Kelly's brother, Cameron, he does a coal mining presentation and has since he was, what, about 8 years old or 10 years old, where he knows how the tools were operated and what they were used for. And he has been giving that presentation. He still gives it to multiple tour groups or at events that we do every year. And people are captivated by it. But, you know, it's been able to allow him to share his knowledge and skills with people that would otherwise not be able to be engaged with him, because he's not really engaged with social media. He's not, you know, somebody that is going to, you know, just show up and start talking to people. You know, it's, we're providing him an outlet and an avenue to do that.
Just to give a little context to that, the program Tyler is referring to is the Little Cities Heritage Interpreter Program. And that's where we identify people, usually because they just walk in and have an interest, you know, but we identify people who have stories that they want to tell about their family or about their place or about research that they've done. And we work with them to turn those stories into kind of a performance. So, and those could be anything from something that's in character to something that's more like a TED Talky kind of format, you know, with slides. But often just as a way to talk to people and tell those stories as, you know, a performing storyteller. And then once they have a really solid performance going on and it's where they're happy with it, we work to help to get them booked for opportunities to give that performance. And that could be at events, at museums, libraries, schools. But we then try to advocate for them on that end so that they're getting that compensation. And in that way, we're trying to show that these stories have value, and their ability to tell these stories and to do the research involved has value. And we want to make sure that they're recognized for that. And one of the things that this has been really helpful with is people who really like a 9-to-5 job is not for them. You know, like they don't want that life. They don't really. Like that hasn't been their family's experience for generations. And, you know, if we were to try to like put them in a job working at the local store, you know, they'd be miserable, you know. But this gives them a way to earn income that's a lot more within their control and that is coming from their passions and their skill sets. And so we're finding that that program is really powerful, and we're hearing some really moving stories from people that are doing it. And we're hoping to keep expanding that program. So that's just like a little piece of our approach to tourism and how it's trying to use these heritage skills.
Yeah, that's great. I'm struck by how strong the focus is, of course, on kind of building and growing people, right? And helping people heal. And that's I think when we talk to people, especially in some of these current and former coal communities, so many people are focused on healing the people and healing the land, and trying to think about things more sustainably. And you know, Kelly, when you were talking about keeping the money in the community, I thought not only about some of the coal communities here in Southern Illinois, but also a place that I used to live, which is Detroit. You know, very different place, but a lot of similar contours in the history, right? Years and years and years of disinvestment. And I would say right now they're actually probably a little bit further along in that path of. There is a sort of quote unquote resurgence or boom happening, but a lot of it is wealthy people who have bought up big portions of the city. And now, yeah, there's a lot more tourists, so there's a lot more visitors coming to Detroit and enjoying Detroit and enjoying the great things that the city has to offer. But that money's not really going to any of the people who have been living there. And so the focus you had on kind of keeping that in the community. I guess my question as we're sort of wrapping up here is how do you think about the idea of ecotourism as a tool to heal people and to heal the land in coal communities and how to make sure it actually does that?
That's the challenge we're facing everywhere, right? And I'm glad you brought up Detroit because we do think that what's going on in urban centers and what's going on in rural communities are very closely aligned. And a lot of the strategies we've used are things that I learned in Chicago, looking at Humboldt Park and Pilsen and neighborhoods who went through a lot of gentrification. And I learned a lot things to look out for that can go wrong, and I learned a lot about things that can help. So I think for us, we think ecotourism can be really strong when it doesn't just focus on visitors, right? And we found this model that we really like, which is the authentic tourism model, which fits very well in sort of where travel is right now, because people, you know, if we went back 20 years, people who were traveling, they wanted like the kind of heavily controlled experience, right? Of going to a chain hotel, going to a resort, you know, going to a museum with a guided tour, things like that. But what we're finding is that people don't want that as much anymore. And in the 21st century, what people are looking for is authenticity. And so there's a tremendous market of visitors who want not just to go to a place and take a picture there, but to understand it and to meet people and to have real connection with the local community and the local culture. So we've been trying to follow this authentic tourism model, which has a lot of principles like to, you know, form gathering places where both locals and visitors are welcome, or, you know, to make sure that there are all of these touch points where tourists can gain real appreciation for the context of what they're seeing and experiencing and things like that. And we think that when we stick with that model, it can become something that not only forms, you know, great visitor experiences, but that also does uplift the communities that are here. Our hope is that by doing that and by forming a lot of these like direct touch points, it's not just about bringing money into the region, you know, it's about also transferring culture and knowledge and skill sets that can help people for generations to come.
Great. Well, I mean, that's a really important goal to keep in mind. I know it's something that I'm thinking about a lot as we, you know, engage here with a lot of our coal communities. Kelly Blosser and Tyler McDaniel, really grateful to speak with you guys and snag a little bit of your time today. Just as we're wrapping up here, how can people follow your continued work?
You can go on our website, which is lcbdohio.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, which is Little Cities of Black Diamonds. And you can follow us on Instagram, which is at the Little Cities of Black Diamonds. You can also see some of our past content we made during COVID, and right after COVID, we shifted to doing some short documentary work. So we have a YouTube channel, again, Little Cities of Black Diamonds. You can check out some of our past videos and things covering the history of the region there. So yeah, and you can always, you know, come visit us in Southeast Ohio. Our office is on Main Street in New Straitsville. You can just go to New Straitsville and ask where the Ward building is. Historically, a woman that ran a restaurant in there for several decades, she kind of lent her name to the building, and our offices are in there. So you can always just stop by. That's how so many people actually find us, is they drive around, and when the weather's warm, our door's open, so people, they see that door open and they pull off and park and yeah, come in and see us and get to learn about the history. So if you want to visit us from Illinois or wherever you're listening to us from, yeah, we'd love to have you stop by.
That's great. Well, again, Kelly Blosser, Tyler McDaniel of the Little Cities of Black Diamonds Council. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having us.
That was my conversation with Kelly Blosser and Tyler McDaniel of the Little Cities of Black Diamonds Council. I want to thank Kelly and Tyler once again for their generosity with their time and for sharing their deep knowledge of their community with me. I came away from our conversation thinking about the importance of stories. When we think about energy transition communities, we often think about all these concrete things like property taxes and job numbers and education, and obviously all those things are important, but the stories people tell about themselves and their families, the stories about place and placemaking in these communities, I think Kelly and Tyler's work shows that not only are these stories just as important as those quantifiable economic factors, they're directly related to them. The work that Kelly and Tyler are doing to sort of build a new economic model in the wake of the coal mining industry in their town, oriented around the people there and their stories and their experiences, shows that there is potentially a different model, right? There's something else that we can do that really values people's experiences and stories, and hopefully builds well-being in the community as well. And I think as we see increased change in not just coal communities, but lots and lots of places due to energy transition, due to the impacts of climate change, certainly something to be thinking about moving forward. So that's today's show. As always, thank you so much for listening to WEFT 90.1 FM, community radio from Champaign, Illinois. As always, the recording of this episode will be online later this evening, and you can listen to it or any recording of any of my previous last shows by accessing the Rift on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or the podcast aggregator of your choosing. For now, we have some tunes up until the top of the hour, and then as usual, it's On the Move with Herbert Burnett. I hope everyone's had a wonderful start to their new year, despite the tough circumstances we all kind of find ourselves in. But until then, take care. I'll see you next time.
My life, it makes me happy. going. Woo!